Welcome to Base by Base.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. You brought us a really fascinating challenge today, looking at one of the absolute biggest questions in science. How did life actually get started on Earth?
Right, and for a long time, a leading idea has been this RNA world hypothesis.
Yeah, the RNA world. The thought is that maybe, just maybe, the very first life wasn't based on the complex DNA and proteins we see today.
But on simpler RNA molecules. And these RNA molecules, they sort of had this dual superpower, didn't they?
Exactly. They could both store information, like a blueprint, yeah, and also act like early enzymes catalysts.
That's right. RNA is, it's truly a remarkable molecule. Even in modern biology, RNA is absolutely essential. You think about ribosomal RNA. That's the fundamental machine, basically, that builds all our proteins from amino acids.
But that kind of highlights the puzzle, right? The puzzle at the core of the RNA world idea.
It does. While RNA makes proteins today, how did RNA itself get going back then?
Especially, how did it get long enough and, complex enough to actually replicate itself and evolve without the help of sophisticated protein catalysts? Those came later.
There seemed to be this critical missing link, a gap in the story.
Exactly. We knew how to chemically stick together the basic building blocks of RNA without enzymes. Non-enzymatic synthesis, they call it.
Sure, that chemistry was known.
But the methods often had, major limitations, especially under conditions thought to be plausible for early Earth.
Right. The RNA chains you got were usually just too short.
And they often had annoying biases, like being overloaded with one type of building block.
Yeah, typically guanine or G. And sometimes the methods required chemical helpers or environments that felt a bit, unlikely, maybe too high in certain salts, which causes other problems.
Like hindering replication.
Exactly. Or needing very specific activators that perhaps weren't just lying around everywhere on early Earth.
And that's where the research you've shared comes in. It's a new paper, right?
Yeah, very recent. Published in Nature Communications in 2025 by Dr. Suraj K. Raut and his colleagues.
Okay.
And this study, it directly tackles that missing link, and it proposes a surprisingly simple solution, something that was potentially present on early Earth right alongside those RNA building blocks.
Okay. So our mission then for this discussion is to really get inside this paper. We want to understand the basic chemical ingredients they started with.
Uh-huh.
Dive into the specific problems they aim to fix from those past attempts, reveal their key, maybe game-changing discovery.
Hopefully.
And then zoom out a bit, see what this means for our overall understanding of how life might have first emerged.
We're essentially exploring one hypothesis for that, that really pivotal chemical leap, from simple molecules to the beginnings of biological complexity.
All right, let's set the stage then. What were the initial building blocks? What did Dr. Raut and the team focus on?
Okay, so they worked with molecules called ribonucleoside 2-erprase ceruloacyclic phosphates, often just shortened to CNMPs.
ZNMMPs.
Yeah.
Got it. And these are plausible for early Earth.
Yes, they're considered quite plausible candidates. They can be formed through relatively simple, non-biological reactions under conditions people think were likely back then.
Interesting.
And what's also interesting is they're produced even today when RNA breaks down naturally. So they really fit the picture, molecules that could have been available in that early environment.
Okay, so these CNMPs are the fundamental chemical units they're trying to link together. Now, you mentioned problems with the previous ways of doing this without enzymes. What were those specific hurdles again?
Right. So past studies did show you could link these CNMPs together. That wasn't the issue. But the problems were significant.
Right.
Well, a major one was just yield.
Yep.
You often got very little actual RNA product.
Not very efficient.
Not at all. And the product you did get was typically very short, maybe just 2, 3, or 4 nucleotides long, tops.
And you need longer chains for anything really interesting biologically to happen, right? Like forming structures or acting as templates for copying.
Absolutely. Length was a big problem. And then there was that composition problem we touched on.
The G bias.
Yeah, exactly. These non-enzymatic reactions often show this really strong bias, preferentially linking together guanine, G nucleotides much more easily than adenine A, uracil U, or cytosine C.
And why isn't RNA that's mostly G's a problem for early life? It seems like you'd want variety.
You absolutely do. Because for RNA to store and transmit information through base pairing, A pairing with U and G pairing with C, you need a diverse sequence.
Makes sense.
A strand that's mostly G's can't really pair up effectively with a complementary strand to form those double helical structures you need for replication, or even fold properly into complex catalytic shapes, potential ribozymes. You need a variety of letters in your RNA alphabet. You need A, U, G, and C to write a diverse library of potential early genetic information or functional molecules.
It's like trying to build a meaningful library of books using only the letter G. It just wouldn't work.
Precisely. And, you know, adding to that, some of the conditions that did manage to link things together, even a little bit, well, they weren't ideal for early Earth scenarios.
Like the high magnesium medium.
Yeah. For example, high magnesium can actually cause the RNA strands you make to clump together or stick too tightly to templates. That hinders the separation needed for replication cycles.
Okay.
Other methods needed specific chemical activators, maybe things like EDC, which might not have been abundant or stable everywhere on early Earth. And even much earlier attempts back in the 70s, I think, to use amino acids had their own limitations.
What kind of limitation?
Things like needing really high temperatures or using chemicals that actually interfered with the reaction, or they just didn't really explore a range of conditions, like different pH levels.
So Dr. Rout and his colleagues essentially asked, can we find a simple, plausible way using molecules likely present on early Earth to connect these CNMPs efficiently, get rid of that G bias, and generate longer, more diverse RNA chains?
That was the core question, yes. They were looking for a catalyst that was simple, effective, and crucially universally available back then.
And this is where their breakthrough comes in. Tell us about the experiment. What did they actually do and what did they find?
Well, the experimental setup was honestly remarkably straightforward.
Simple is good in origin of life research.
It really is. They took solutions containing those CNMPs, the building blocks, and simply mixed them with different proteinogenic amino acids.
The standard amino acids that make up proteins today.
The very same ones. Then they put these mixtures onto a surface, like a microscope slide, and rapidly dried them under a stream of nitrogen gas.
Okay, what does the drying step mimic?
It mimics a really plausible early Earth scenario. Think of a shallow puddle or a thin film of water on a rock surface just drying out in the sun or wind. Wet, dry cycles.
Right. Okay. And then?
Then they just incubated these dried films at room temperature.
Room temperature. That's a huge difference from meeting boiling water or something. That feels much more, well, geochemically plausible for widespread reaction.
It absolutely is. Much more likely to happen across diverse environments. And the result was, frankly, striking.
Yeah.
The amino acids dramatically increased the amount of RNA oligo, those linked chains that were formed.
How much of an increase are we talking?
We're talking about more than a 100-fold increase in the total yield of RNA product compared to identical conditions where they left the amino acids out.
Wait, 100-fold?
Oh.
Okay, that's not just a minor tweak. That's fundamentally changing the efficiency of the reaction.
It's a massive boost, yeah. It transforms what was a pretty sluggish, inefficient reaction into something quite robust.
Wow.
And the details of what RNA was produced are just as important, maybe even more so.
Okay, tell me about that. The composition.
Exactly. Look at the yields without amino acids. Only cGMP, the guanine one, gave a significant yield, about 26%. The others were barely reactive. cUMP was like 0.7%. cMP, 0.17%. And ccMP, cytosine, a mere 0.06%.
Okay, so that's the strong G bias right there. A very unbalanced production line.
Precisely. But then add an amino acid like valine, for instance, and the picture changes completely. G still reacted well, about 39% yield, but the yields for all the other nucleotides increased significantly. cUMP jumped to 4.8%, cMP to 8.4%, and ccMP shot up to 7.3%.
So they all become much more comparable.
Much more comparable. And crucially, the largest fold increases were for the nucleotides that were initially the least reactive. Cytosine saw a staggering 122-fold jump.
Wow.
Adenine, a 49-fold jump. Uracil, about 6.8-fold. And guanine, just a modest 1.5-fold increase because it was already reactive.
So the amino acids didn't just speed everything up. They actively counteracted that built-in G bias. They leveled the playing field.
Yes, exactly. They made the pool of resulting RNA sequences potentially much more diverse and balanced from the get-go.
And that diversity is crucial for, well, for actually doing something useful like templating.
Precisely. For information transfer, for base pairing. What's more, the amino acids also help make longer chains.
They tackled the length problem too.
They did. Without amino acids, getting chains longer than maybe four nucleotides was rare, or basically non-existent for ANC. But with amino acids, they detected oligomers longer than four, and even up to seven nucleotides long for ANC.
And getting past that four nucleotide threshold is important.
It is, yeah. You generally need chains longer than four bases to form stable base pairs with a template strand during replication. So this is a big step.
This is really starting to sound like a potential answer to that missing link problem. Amino acids are clearly powerful catalysts here. But how? How are they doing it? What's the chemistry?
The evidence they gathered points strongly towards a pretty fundamental chemical principle, acid-base catalysis.
Acid-base catalysis. Okay, refresh my memory. That's about molecules donating and accepting protons, hydrogen ions, to make a reaction go easier.
That's the core idea, yes. The researchers found that this RNA formation, the oligomerization, was most efficient when they added amino acids, and the pH of the solution was around 9 to 10.
pH 9 to 10. Okay, slightly alkaline. Why is that range significant?
It's particularly significant because it's very close to the pKa, that's basically the acidity constant of the amino group within the amino acids they tested. That pKa is typically around 9.6 for these alpha amino acids.
Right. And at a pH near the pKa, you have roughly equal amounts of the molecule in both its acidic form, which has the extra proton,
The ammonium form.
and its basic form, which has lost the proton.
The MM form, correct. This equilibrium, having both forms present, seems to be key.
So how does HAT help the reaction?
Well, the proposed mechanism is that at this optimal pH, the basic form, the amine group, can efficiently grab a proton from the molecule that's about to attack and form the bond. In this case, that's the 5-hydroxyl group, 5-OH, of one nucleotide.
Okay, pulls off a proton.
Right. And at the same time, the acidic form, the ammonium group, can donate a proton to the chemical group that needs to leave for the bond to form, specifically one of the oxygen atoms on that cyclic phosphate of the other nucleotide.
So it's like a coordinated handoff. Take one here, give one there.
Exactly. This coordinated shuttling of protons, donating and accepting, dramatically lowers the energy barrier required for the transphosphorylation reaction. That's the specific chemical step that forms the phosphodiester bond, linking the nucleotides together.
It's like the amino acid acts as a tiny chemical assistant, perfectly positioned to grab a proton from one spot and hand one over to another, guiding those two RNA building blocks to sort of snap together more easily.
That's a really good way to visualize it. And interestingly, they also noticed that even without amino acids, the self-linking of G and U also peaked around their own pKa values, which are also around 9.3.
Suggesting the same acid-base principle is generally at play.
It suggests that yes, but the amino acids are just far more effective catalysts. And crucially, they extend this catalytic boost to all the bases, especially the ones like A and C that don't have those helpful alkaline pKa values themselves to drive the reaction on their own.
Okay, that explains the general mechanism.
Yeah.
But they also found something else interesting. Which amino acid you used mattered quite a bit, right? The hydrophobic ones work best.
Yes, that was another key finding. They saw the greatest catalytic enhancement, the biggest boost, with hydrophobic amino acids. Things like valine, leucine, isoleucine.
And the polar ones.
Polar amino acids were generally less effective, and in some cases, like for guanine, they even seem to inhibit the reaction slightly.
So why would hydrophobic amino acids be better? What's the thinking there? Initially, you might think it's just about creating a less watery, sort of greasy environment around the reaction.
Yeah, like pushing the reacting molecules closer together just by excluding water. That was definitely one hypothesis.
Makes intuitive sense.
It does. So they used computational modeling quantum chemistry calculations to actually test this idea. They looked at whether the bulk hydrophobicity of the environment, measured by something called the dielectric constant, significantly changed the activation energy, the energy needed for the reaction to happen.
And did it.
The calculations suggested no, not really. It didn't seem like the overall hydrophobic nature of the environment was the main factor driving the catalytic boost.
Okay, so it wasn't just creating a kind of chemical grease trap for the reaction.
Yeah.
So what did the modeling suggest was actually happening? Why are valine and leucine better catalysts here?
This is where another type of simulation, molecular dynamics, came in handy. These simulations actually model how molecules move and interact over time, like a tiny molecular movie. And what those simulations revealed was that the amino acids that were the most effective catalysts, which included those hydrophobic ones like valine, leucine, isoleucine, but also, interestingly, lysine.
Lysine. That's basic, but it has a long hydrocarbon chain, right? So partly hydrophobic.
Exactly. Those effective amino acids showed a higher tendency, a greater propensity to form specific hydrogen bonds. Not just anywhere, but specifically with the phosphate group of the CNMP, and sometimes even with the nucleobase part itself.
So the side chain isn't just passively making the area hydrophobic. It's actively reaching out and interacting, helping to position the amino acid correctly.
Precisely. It seems the side chain acts almost like a handle or an anchor. It helps to correctly orient and position the amino acid molecule right next to the reactive cyclic phosphate group.
Positioning the catalytic part, the aminoammonium group, exactly where it needs to be.
Yes, this precise positioning ensures that the basic amine group is close enough to grab the proton from the 5-OH, and the acidic ammonium group is close enough to donate its proton to the leaving oxygen on the phosphate. It makes the acid-base catalysis much more efficient.
That's a really elegant piece of chemistry, a specific interaction, not just a general environmental effect. Okay, so pulling all this together now, what are the really crucial implications of these findings for our understanding of early life?
Well, this study offers several really significant implications, I think. First and foremost, by breaking that G bias and dramatically boosting the yields for all the bases, especially CNA, these amino acids create a much more compositionally diverse pool of RNA oligomers than we previously thought possible under simple non-enzymatic conditions.
And that diversity, as you said, is absolutely essential. You need variety for information storage, for base pairing, for replication to even get started.
Exactly. You need a varied sequence library, and you need sequences that are long enough, longer than 4 nucleotides, really, to allow for stable hybridization to a template strand during replication, or even to fold into functional structures like potential early ribozymes. A diverse pool of RNA sequences is basically a prerequisite for chemical evolution to begin.
So this helps solve the getting diverse longer sequences problem. What else stands out?
They also found that when amino acids were present, there was a preference for forming the natural 3-foot-5 phosphodiester linkages.
That's the type of bond that forms the backbone of RNA and DNA today.
Yes, exactly. It forms preferentially over the non-natural 2-foot-5 linkages, which can also form chemically but are less biologically relevant. So it's helping build the right kind of backbone structure.
Building it right from the start. Good. Any other key implications?
Yes, and this one is potentially really exciting. It relates to recycling.
Recycling.
Yeah. Remember those alkaline conditions they found were optimal for polymerization around pH 9-10? Well, those conditions also have another property. They can facilitate the fragmentation, the hydrolysis of longer RNA sequences, breaking them down.
Okay, but wouldn't that just destroy the RNA you just made?
Ah, but here's the crucial part. Under these specific conditions, this hydrolysis, this breakdown, can occur in a way that reforms the very same activated 2-foot-3-3-3 cyclic phosphate monomers they started with.
Wait, really? So the longer chains aren't just dead ends? They can be broken back down into the active building blocks, ready to be used again in another round of polymerization.
Exactly. It provides a really plausible mechanism for recycling material. Imagine a dynamic early Earth setting, maybe with those wet-dry cycles we talked about. You could have polymerization happening in the drying phases, making RNA chains. Then, in the wet phases, rehydration and the alkaline conditions could cause hydrolysis, breaking down maybe less successful or shorter sequences, and feeding their components back into the pool as activated CNMP monomers.
Ready for another round of synthesis when it dries out again?
Precisely. This kind of recycling is absolutely vital for sustaining any sort of prebiotic chemical evolution. You can't just make stuff once, you need cycles.
That's a huge point, the potential for continuous cycling rather than just a one-way street to degradation. And did the researchers connect these specific conditions, the pH, the drying, to plausible early Earth environments?
They did, yeah. The conditions that worked best, low salt freshwater, pH around 9-10, and involving drying are actually quite consistent with scenarios people propose for early Earth. Things like shallow ponds or lakes in low-temperature volcanic areas, or maybe carbonate-rich lakes, which can naturally be alkaline,
And the wet-dry cycles.
could easily be driven by day-night temperature swings, maybe tidal changes near coastlines, or just fluctuating water levels in pools. They also point out how porous rocks, common in volcanic landscapes, could provide ideal surfaces for these wet-dry cycles.
Offering protection, too.
Yeah, protection from harsh UV radiation, maybe, and helping to concentrate these precursor molecules on the surfaces.
And I think I recall seeing some other recent work suggesting that geothermal heat flows like you might find near hydrothermal vents, could also help concentrate and separate precursor molecules.
That's right, and potentially even enrich some of the very amino acids, like the hydrophobic ones that this study found were most effective.
So this research seems to offer a compelling chemical mechanism that actually aligns quite nicely with specific, plausible, early Earth geological and environmental conditions.
It really ties things together quite well, I think.
Okay, let's try to bring it all together then. What's the overarching significance of this work by Dr. Rout and his colleagues? What's the main takeaway?
Well, I think the core finding is really powerful. Simple amino acids, molecules that were almost certainly present on early Earth, can act as highly effective catalysts for making RNA from plausible precursors under relevant conditions without needing complex enzymes.
It provides that crucial missing piece, maybe, or at least a very strong candidate for it. How RNA chains could have formed efficiently and, importantly, with useful diversity before biology invented sophisticated protein enzymes.
Exactly. It shows a clear functional role for amino acids much, much earlier in the story of life than we might have assumed. Not just as building blocks made by RNA later on, but as helpers in RNA's own creation.
Active participants right from the start.
Right. The study demonstrates the how that acid-base catalysis, likely enhanced by specific positioning from the amino acid side chains, and the outcome is hugely significant. Much higher yields of RNA, a reversal of that problematic G bias leading to increased sequence diversity, a preference for the correct 3-foot, 5-foot backbone linkages, and a potential mechanism for recycling the components.
All vital steps. Steps towards generating RNA molecules that were long enough and varied enough to potentially replicate and actually begin the process of Darwinian evolution at the chemical level.
Absolutely. It really challenges that strict RNA-only worldview, doesn't it? It suggests a more intertwined, maybe even synergistic relationship between RNA and amino acids right from the very beginning.
Amino acids weren't just passive passengers waiting to be incorporated into proteins. They were potentially active players in the very formation of the RNA world itself.
It reveals this potential foundational cooperation between these two key classes of biomolecules, perhaps right at the dawn of life. It's a really fascinating glimpse into the complex chemistry that might have paved the way for biology as we know it.
It really makes you think, though, about the elegance in seemingly simple interactions. You know, molecules that were likely just there on early Earth, like these common amino acids, could perform these fundamental catalytic roles, facilitating the creation of the very molecules needed for information and function without needing elaborate machinery.
It highlights just how much crucial chemistry could have happened through these non-enzymatic pathways, basically setting the stage for everything that followed. It's quite profound, really.
So here's a thought to leave you with. If simple amino acids, readily available in that early Earth inventory, could dramatically boost RNA formation and shape its composition towards greater diversity and length under these plausible wet-dry alkaline conditions. Well, what other surprising cross-catalytic interactions between different types of early biomolecules might have been crucial in those first precarious steps towards life? And could these initial chemical friendships, like the one Dr. Rout and his colleagues have uncovered between amino acids and RNA formation, have even played a role, perhaps, in guiding the evolution of something as fundamental as the genetic code itself? Definitely something to ponder. This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License, CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.